Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Put that up.
Yep, we're on it. We're going.
For assembling the backdrop.
Yeah.
Okay, we've found our tape and our podcast, so we're away. It's great to have Kate Jennings back at the Sydney Institute. Of course, she delivered our annual lecture at Star City, where everyone was in black tars and whatever else, about 4 years ago, I think. Oh. Yeah.
Four years ago.
But tonight she's come back to a basic night at the Sydney Institute. So she's well known to many of you, but I'll introduce her briefly. Kate Jennings, a poet, essayist, and novelist, comes from the Riverina in New South Wales. She attended Sydney University in the late 1960s, where she gained notoriety as a feminist activist. She moved to New York City in 1979. Her novel, Snake, was a New York Times notable book of the year, as was, of course, Moral Hazard. It was around the time of the release of Moral Hazard that Kate spoke at her annual dinner, which was based on her experience as a Wall Street scriptwriter. And she's been nominated for many prizes and whatever else, but on this occasion she's in Australia around the time of the publication by Random House of Stanley and Sophie by Kate Jennings, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of that, and I'm sure Kate will be happy to sign them later. But for now, Kate's going to talk to us about Notes from New York in an Election Year. Many thanks.
When I spoke at the thank you for being here, and just wanted to say when I spoke at the gala, you know, I started off with Bob Marley, Redemption Song, very loud. And unfortunately, I don't have anything quite like that today. I've been doing a lot of publicity for my dog book. It's actually not really a dog book. It's a dog munchkin save the world book. Okay, dog munchkin save the world book. There is a lot of politics in there. But just coming off from an interview with an ABC guy who began the interview by saying, I just spent a vacation with a Border Terrier. My dog's a Border Terrier. And they're really the ugliest dogs I've ever seen. at which point I should have said, end of the interview, I'm out of here. And then he really wanted to get stuck into this thing, anthropomorphism. Clearly on the side that, you know, one should not be anthropomorphic. And he really sort of banged on about this, and finally I said, okay, dogs are not humans. My dogs don't read. And then I said, rather pathetically, but they do like music. So anyway, go easy on me tonight, huh? Okay, this was hard to put together. In fact, just before I left, I went and checked the New York Times, the FT, in the Sydney Morning Herald to see if there was any breaking news, because writing about elections in the markets, it's incredibly interesting, but it's also a moving target, to say the least. We decided to call this Notes from New York in an Election Year. It's a fair review because they're definitely notes. There are no resounding conclusions or an intricate thesis, just some thoughts to chew on. Two phrases in particular to chew on: pig in a poke and its bright, guilty world. I shall get to that. The US election season has been turned over. It's been tilled and plowed and bulldozed so often by pundits that all that's left is pulverized soil. Everyone is having a say, and not without cause. The punditocracy is beside itself, because it's in virgin territory. A black man running for the President of the United States. A young, Harvard educated black man. Who would have thought? One Politico, astutely described this coming election as possibly being a tsunami election. What he was trying to say is that it won't be like any other election. All our preconceived ideas will be swept away because of the intense disgust with the Iraq War. And I'm not sure whether you are hearing that here. The disgust is intense.
Just on the hearing issue, can you speak a bit more into the microphone? Because I think...
It could be the microphone.
Are you having problems down the back or not?
Yeah.
You want to okay, listen. Well, let's work this out.
Well, that's...
Yes, it is. Yeah. Is there a volume? Why don't you...
I'll take a...
So if you talk like that, you can hear it.
Yeah. If you talk like that, you can't.
So you really need to talk right in.
It's one of those kind of markers. That's the problem. It's called a directional mark, I think.
So it's Sunny and Cher kind of.
Yeah. That's right. Yes, eat it, Kate.
Give me Bob Marley.
Okay, the tsunami election. It won't be like any other election. All our preconceived ideas will be swept away. Because of the intense disgust with the Iraq War and the staggering, jaw-dropping fiscal irresponsibility of the Bush administration and the Karl Rove-induced polarization that has paralyzed US government, there is the possibility of real change. The racial divide won't matter, or won't matter as much. It'll be neutralized or reduced by the tragedy of the last 8 years, or so the line of reasoning goes. You'll expect me now to talk some more about Obama. I want instead to talk for a bit about Clay Shirky. Has he talked to you?
No.
Clay Shirky?
Not yet.
He's written a book called Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. Now, a techie friend thrust it upon me as I left New York. I tried to read it. I tried very, very hard to read it. Because I hate being thought of as an old fart by know-it-all techies. Over half the book involves an interminable story about a gal who loses her cell phone and how a movement, so to speak, of her friends and acquaintances was able to retrieve it via web social sites. Plumbing new depths of inanity, or so I thought. My techie friend and I argue about the web. He thinks I'm a dinosaur because I like clear sentences and well-constructed arguments. He can't spell, knows zip about punctuation, wouldn't recognise a well-constructed argument if he fell over it, but he was full of enthusiasm for the internet and its possibilities. Well, actually, so am I. I think the internet is absolutely extraordinary. I do all my shopping online, all of it. And I use Amazon and Wikipedia all the time. I do all my research online. But I'm not part of any web social network, and I don't read blogs. The last book I read on the internet, about the internet, was Andrew King's Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Culture. This book seemed to me to be spot on. Communities on the web are, by and large, disastrously narcissistic, eye-crossingly moronic, and don't give a tinker's damn about piracy or plagiarism or fact-based editing. Qualms about this vast, ever-growing mosh pit of noxious mediocrity, and I mean every adjective, are usually shrugged off by web true believers. No problem, they say. The cream will always rise to the top. Doomsayers like Andrew Keane and myself think it's impossible for cream to rise to the top when communication channels are clogged with half-baked opinions, illiterate rants, and skateboarding dogs. Okay, that's the downside of Here Comes Everybody. The barbarian hordes. Punctuation cretins. Still, I wanted to understand this Shirky fellow. He's the bright boy of the moment. So I watched a video of a seminar on the future of the internet where Shirky was a participant. Lots of preening. We're talking young Turks here. Very pleased with themselves. But interesting nonetheless. Shirky argued that because of the web, we're experiencing an enormous cognitive surplus. And right through history, whenever there are surpluses of any kind, there's change. In his view, the web has pushed huge amounts of flexibility out into society. You don't have to ask for help or permission for trying or attempting anything. And that being the case, the internet has many futures, filled with diverse surprises. Now back to Obama. One of those diverse surprises, and the upside of here comes everybody, is the election of Barack Obama as a Democratic nominee for the presidency of the United States. He became the nominee in part because of his charisma, his obvious intelligence, and his ability to give effortless, nuanced speeches. And that's smart. Melt glaciers quicker than global warming. And also because of Hillary's campaign missteps. But of course, we argued that he was elected because of his extraordinary fundraising machine, which utilized the very flexibility to which Shirky refers. There is a full account of this by Joshua Green in the June issue of The Atlantic, and I really urge you to read it. But to summarize, behind Obama's run is a group of Silicon Valley brainiacs who borrowed the subscription model that the software business had been using since the internet bubble burst. Funds were diminished, and so it didn't make sense to pony up large sums to buy software. Instead, you could have access to it on a subscription basis, small sums over time. This idea was applied to fundraising for Obama. Instead of giving one lump sum to a campaigner, usually cajoled out of you in your living room, you joined mybarackobama.com and committed yourself to a certain sum over a period of time. And you got your friends to join through MySpace or LinkedIn or other social networking sites. And the momentum grew and it grew. The end result, Obama's campaign is bringing in 2 million a day, 200 million in the last year. By comparison, Hillary's campaign was deep in debt. And Obama's staff went from 0 employees to 700. And the staff is already on the ground in all the states preparing for the election in November. They're raring to go. Nobody has seen anything like it before. As well, here comes everybody, is changing government itself, with hubs of power, courtesy of web flexibility, moving outside the beltway. This is here comes everybody in the very best sense. But who are the everybodies? Young people. The word on them for a long time, especially by my baby boomer friends, is that they were beyond apathetic. They were zeros intent on instant gratification. It's a wondrous thing that they've been motivated to care, to become involved, to think that their votes matter. And early initiation in grassroots politics can mean a lifetime of commitment to the greater good. More interesting, though, is that a whole new voting bloc has been mobilized via technology. The Obama people are getting virtual voters to real booths. You could call this technologically enhanced democracy. People are upgrading to Obama-style politics, which is much more satisfying than old-style spectatorial politics. It's more connected, a more perfect union, to use the name of Obama's race speech in Philadelphia, of candidate and constituency. Because so many of Obama's supporters are young, some, that is, old people, worry that they can't be relied to vote on election day. Short attention spans. I'm not sure that that holds true. Their phones are probably primed to ring to remind them to get off their buses. What is marked about this election year is the amount of people who've been turning out for the primaries. Voting in the US isn't compulsory, which means only a pathetic fraction votes. And there are endless efforts to disenfranchise voters by the Republicans, especially the poor and the black people who would vote Democrat. There's a very funny story. There's a number of states who are now requiring government photo ID can't vote if you don't have one. And this was said, a lot of poor people clearly don't have that kind of documentation. But what happened was a whole bus full of very old nuns arrived at the polling booth ready to vote. And of course, they don't have that kind of documentation. They're turned away. This year in the primaries, voter turnout was at historically high levels, with many contests setting all-time records for turnout. Voter turnout on Super Tuesday was at 27% of eligible citizens, breaking the previous record of 25.9% set in 1972. Turnout was higher among Democrats than Republicans, with Democratic turnout surpassing Republican turnout even in traditionally red states, where the number of registered Democrats is proportionally low. from January 3rd through February 5, Democratic turnout exceeded Republican turnout, 19.1 million to 13.1 million, and this trend, as far as I can determine, continued up to June and Hillary's capitulation. And of course, there's the oft-quoted rally in Portland, Oregon, where 75,000 white supporters showed up for Obama. I personally wouldn't make too much of this. Portland, Oregon, it's a loosey-goosey-ish sort of place. They drink lots of coffee and ride bikes and they're fond of the outdoors. Not much else to do. I've been in Australia for months now, and I feel like I've been unplugged from a frenetic Heath Robinson Rube Goldberg machine. Politics. That's just about all we've talked about this past year. That and the markets. Never before have I seen politics debated so feverishly and at such a pitch. In New York, we've all become political junkies. The cabbie, the doorman, the sushi maker. And we've shaken our heads more than once that after all these years of waiting, we had both a woman and a black guy running. To give you an idea of how preoccupied we are with politics, let me mention my new book, Stanley and Sophie, this is a plug. I got the idea of writing it after reading Thomas Mann's Basham and I. Mann wrote his book in the middle of the First World War as a way of not having to think about its appalling carnage. Excellent idea, I thought. New Yorkers had lived through September 11 and two terms of George Bush. And we felt a bit like Job. And we certainly didn't feel safe. In the book, I described it this way. Our lives were a rhubarb of noisy emotion, a devil's chorus of fear, blatting rage, burring anxiety, tweedling incredulity, rupee sorrow. I do like the good adjective. Unlike Mann, I couldn't keep politics out of the book. The reality of our lives was that we were ping-ponging all the time from the personal to the political, like it or not. The most perfidious US president before George Bush was Nixon. I've asked friends who've lived through that era whether these last 8 years have been worse. Much worse, they always reply. Always on our minds, always intruding. By the way, in regard to George W. Bush, we've gone from outrage to embarrassment. Republicans, if anything, are more embarrassed than Democrats. Anyway, we're counting the days. So in the end, I didn't take a break, a vacation from the troubles of our time. I voted for Hillary in the House. She's an extraordinary woman. I caught a cold from my 6-year-old nephew. Sniffling and coughing. I voted for Hillary in the primaries. She is an extraordinary woman and would have made an excellent president. I love Bill too, even though he broke our hearts when he couldn't keep it zipped. But the worst of the Clintons came out in the last few months. And if she had won, what was she going to do with Bill? Send him to the North Pole in the hope that his temper would cool and his you-know-what would freeze and drop off. I changed my allegiance to Obama when I heard him give his race speech. I'm a speechwriter by trade, and I'm in complete awe of that speech. He even quoted Faulkner. He might only be 46 years old, but anyone smart enough to give that speech is smart enough to surround himself with people who won't truck in conventional wisdom. Also, he's not beholden to interest groups in the way that time-serving polls inevitably are. Still, given the appalling state of the nation, a despised war, the Constitution introduced, the Geneva Convention, government agencies purposely trashed in the name of small government, feckless bankers who've driven the economy into a recession. We're taking a tremendous risk in electing him. Will he be our wise, measured statesman, or are we getting a pig in a poke? An idealistic intellectual. We just don't know. And I've been calling friends in New York in the last few days, and even the ones who have been for Obama, they're nervous. They're really nervous. A digression here on the idiom pig in a poke. I looked up its origins. I don't know how many of you know this, but a poke is a Middle Ages word for a bag. meat was scarce back then, so unscrupulous people would put cats in a bag and sell the wriggling sack as a sucking pig. Strangely enough, the idiom and the con is much the same across many cultures. Cats in bags the world over. Just thought you'd like to know. I'm afraid that some would say that an idealistic young intellectual is a pygmatope. We're going to find out. And now for the backdrop against which the cabbie, the doorman, and the sushi maker are bending each other's ears with such ferocity. The other phrase I asked you to keep in mind was, it's a bright, guilty world. These are lines spoken by the Orson Welles character, Black Irish, in the movie The Lady from Shanghai. He gets caught up with a nefarious bunch when he falls for Rita Hayworth and has a hard time keeping his moral compass. He and his companions dock their yacht in Acapulco. Black Irish looks around at the languorous wealth and says, it's a bright, guilty world. It's a bright, guilty world where I live. I'm just up the street from 15 Central Park West, where an apartment has been sold for a record-setting $48 million. The building isn't a glass tower. It's a hunking pastiche of pre-Welk styles to give residents a feeling of solidity. And the way the markets are going, they might need that immersion. Here's a startling statistic. In 1993, 1% of families in the US pocketed 14% of the nation's income. By 2006, that slice had grown to 23%. And if you dissect that figure even further, 15,000 families in the top 0.01% drew 5.5% of the nation's total income. It's a bright, guilty world. I did have a story to tell you about going to Cipriani's, but I think I'm running out of time. Anyway, I've written at greater length about bankers and the subprime crisis and related issues in the Fin Review magazine. Financial bungling to end all such bungling. About all I can add, it's not over, however the banks might be spinning it. It's not a time for complacency, not in the US, the UK, Europe, or here. I get an FX newsletter from a woman called Barbara Rockefeller, and if any of you are, you don't actually have to be interested in FX stuff to enjoy this. She writes very clearly and with a great sense of humour, and her overviews of the market, and especially given what's going on at the moment, they're really terrific. If I could just quote her, she's just funny and she doesn't toe any line. And I quote her, pundits are now saying the recession will be shallow but long-lasting. Keep in mind the economist's ever-present warning of pari passu, meaning if everything else remains the same, or if everything else remains equal. I think it's also a term for lawyers. But everything else never does remain the same. The world is full of new developments, and some of them are one-time shocks that change everything. This is me now. As I understand it, economic and market systems require a degree of order and balance to function. When the potential distortions are too great, the stress reactions become both hard to predict and manage. Notions of market timing, they're useless. We're back to the internet, back to Shirky, back to here comes everybody. The markets are unmanageable when here comes everybody. Computers allow gigantic flows into and out of funds and allow rumours, the true market engine, to cascade like the Victoria Falls. They turbocharge greed, stupidity and lemming-like behaviour, never in short supply, and the cream, prudence, gets dispersed and pushed to the bottom. The great philosopher Isaiah Berlin observed before his death that the scale in change in the medium of communication methodologies in the past two decades has profoundly altered the physical equations in ways that we are only just beginning to understand. The operative word here is scale, and I think we can add the speed to that as well. And it's certainly producing diverse surprises, and they're not necessarily good. Back in the 80s, we had 40 financial products. This I got from one of the big swinging dicks on the Solomon floor. 40 financial products. Henry Kaufman said that. Now we have more than 240. We can leverage everything, every which way to kingdom come, in ways that we could never have imagined and can't control. As a good friend remarked, and this is someone who's been involved in the commodity markets all his life, to think we can control risk in these circumstances is a besetting and dangerous vanity. commodities, the price of oil, very much in our minds. Is the problem supply and demand or speculators driving up the price? Speculators, the market needs them, of course, but the scale has changed. Here's a figure. $90 billion have flowed into commodity index funds in the first part of the year, and most of that money is coming from investors, from speculators. There's speculators going long. Like it or not, you have multiple bubbles in the commodity markets, regardless of what politicians might be saying in Australia at the moment. The pros, Soros and company, are getting out of energy, but they're not going to gold or other commodities. Gold, in fact, is dropping. The pros are going liquid. Making things much worse, you have a political vacuum in the US. Bush and Cheney could not be more disassociated from the markets. And Henry Paulson hasn't found his voice, to put it politely. In China, less said about China the better. They solve their problems with very blunt economic instruments. The regulators in the US are working overtime to figure stuff out. They bring to mind the boy with his finger in the dike. They know that the off-the-books markets need to be brought onto the books. But when that happens, what will turn up? What's under the rug? We don't have a clue. If the regulators were to ask US banks to have enough money, their capital requirements to be safe, it's estimated that they would have to come up, this is in America only, with $400 billion to $500 billion. Sovereign wealth funds are going to throw their hands up at that point. And so we're not just in uncharted territory election-wise in the US, we are in an uncharted territory market-wise. Until OTC instruments are regulated and credit requirements spelled out, until we can get some understanding of the here comes everybody aspect of the markets, that will remain the case. I did ask one of my friends after I'd heard all this gloom and doom, and this is just awful, and I said, what's going to happen? And he basically said, banking as we know it won't exist anymore. He sees it as a crisis on the same level as global warming. To finish these notes, perhaps far too much has been made of gender and race in the primaries this last year. Two very capable people ran for the Democratic Party nomination. But let us not forget that for the first time in the US, a woman ran and nearly won the nomination at a time when the representation of women in the Senate and the House of Representatives is woeful. 13 out of 100 in the Senate, 61 out of 535 in the House. And let us not forget that a black man ran and won the Democratic Party nomination at a time when one out of three black men between the ages of 20 and 29 are incarcerated. Again, one out of three. Men who will spend the rest of their lives disenfranchised, of course. Although my point is that Obama is running for president in a society that tolerates a very high degree of institutionalized racism. The markets, the elections, I hope for the best, but I wouldn't bet on them.
Many thanks, Kate. So, as I said, Jenna Cruddy has got some copies. Those out there, you can come in. It's not quite like church. You don't have to stay down the back or out the door. Now, Jenna Cruddy's got copies of Stanley and Sophie. There's no care in here. And I'm sure Kate'd be happy to sign them later. And I have a dog who doesn't listen to music, but probably because she's deaf, I don't know.
Maybe she reads.
Now, before we... So we're into question discussion. We finish no later than 7 o'clock. The one person you didn't... You spoke about the possible election of a woman, which didn't come to pass. You spoke about the primary victory of nomination victory of Afro-American, which did come into place. But there's also the older of us are interested in a 71-year-old Republican called J. John McCain, you didn't talk about
the
older generation. So do your dogs listen to him?
No, actually they don't. I think McCain, unfortunately, is a very old,
He's 72 in January next year.
He's somewhat, shall we say, somewhat rigid. The mind is not agile. And if you actually go on his website and look at his economic proposal, you'd be appalled. And I think the Democrats are taking the line that, you know, you elect McCain, you are electing George Bush for another term, essentially, because who said that you can never go broke underestimating the American public? I mean, you know, it's quite possible that they could vote for McCain. If racism is that, is that being bad? To say we really don't know. It's absolutely fascinating.
Now, I'll get you to focus back on talking into the microphone. Right. There's a question here. Yeah.
So I was wondering, you know, how real it was that Hillary Clinton is claiming that she actually gets the popular vote, and in fact the working class Americans plus the Catholics won't vote for an Afro-American.
When push comes to shove, they will, the Democrats. I think that's something that she said to try to help her cause. I said in the speech that the last couple of months have just brought out the worst in the Clintons. So I really like both of them, but I think some of the tactics they used not great. And whether this whole thing of counting the popular vote depends on how you count it. You know. But the other thing is also that the primary system is really strange. I mean, how they do this. I've had the great good fortune to go to two conventions, to the Democratic National Convention when Bill was nominated, and to the RNC, the last RNC convention. And American politics, oh my, you walk in there and you see the sort of this thousands of people with their hats on and their banners and they're going berserk. And you think, oh, I'll never do that. And in 2 seconds flat, you're doing it.
Helen.
I want to ask about the wives, Michelle and Cindy. What role are they going to play in the outcome of the election? I mean, I listened to an interview with Michelle Obama a little while ago, and I thought they could solve the gender and race problem by having her as the candidate. I mean, she struck me as terrific. And apparently she's very much loved by potential voters. It's said that if she were a white woman, Obama's popularity would be lower amongst African Americans. But there's the other factor of a black first lady. Is America ready for a black first lady? On the other hand, Cindy McCain, what is she? Is she? We know nothing about her other than that she looks very much like a sort of
textbook
president's wife.
I like
her. You like her. I mean, she looks like the actor you would cast as the president's wife in a movie. But is she going to...
People are actually wondering whether she will be up to it.
Is she going to be... I mean, is Michelle going to be an asset? Is Cindy not, you know... How are these women
going to
play their part?
Michelle Obama is absolutely brilliant. She's extraordinary. But she's black. She's really black. Whereas Obama is, you know, he's not so black. And he's not African-American either. She is African-American. And she has all the willfulness, obduracy that black women get. Now, I think she's fantastic. The day that they get sworn in at the White House, it's Michelle that I'm going to be so pleased about in a strange way. But already the right are coming out in full force, and, you know, the Antichrist and goodness knows what they're calling her. They've really, really made her a target. And again, it's you know, it's shades of blackness, but, you know, that's what they're going after, and that's what they'll, you know, they'll try and scare people. Racism in America is deep and wide.
And how does anybody know anything about it?
Not a whole lot. I think there's maybe some drug dependency stuff on there in the background, shaking and over and over. Yeah. Oh.
Got my support.
When you get into drug dependency, I think Cindy's had a bit of that too.
That's what
you're
saying.
Yeah, apart from the Republican side, I mean, we've got a black candidate opposed to a white old man. But when Nixon was up against the government, and there was no black element in it, the government's left wing policy. Do you lose every state except one?
Yeah.
To what extent is it the McGovern factor that's more of a worry for Obama, being so liberal and so intellectually elite, being cheered on by a group of people who got it wrong in 2004 badly? I mean, is this his Achilles heel, not the blackness? The idea that he just is too left liberal, and in the last analysis, people may go back to what they did with McGovern.
With the McGovern spectre, no, the McGovern spectre is raised all the time, of course.
So, could you flesh it out first? I mean, how do you see that applying with Obama?
What I said at the beginning was that it's a tsunami election. It won't apply because of what's been happening in the last 8 years. Things are really, really bad. I mean, I think the Iraq war you know about, but basically every government agency in the United States, the wheels are falling off. You know, whether it's the FDA or the whatever, you name it, it's not working. The infrastructure is crumbling. The election is going to help, you know. But this is all the reason to elect somebody completely new. People are really, really, really want change.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. The polls don't suggest that Obama is so far ahead of McCain. It's almost line ball. So what's the problem?
I think in this last week, I mean, it's only really been, a week since Hillary...
He's had enormous popularity.
I think it's just... he has only just started going after it. If you put Obama up against McCain, debate-wise, the general feeling is that he's really going to thrash him. He's just that much better.
Someone left on a wall. guilty parties are down the back. I've got their names to say that. We're in a legal company here, so we can easily sue them. So let's just wait for that to disappear. Now, someone had a question down. I missed someone. Okay, here, and there was someone there. Okay, yeah.
Could you tell us how important the choice of running mate is going to be?
I've heard some people say it's completely irrelevant. It never has been relevant. Then again, I think because Obama is black, that it probably, if he picks somebody white from the South, it actually really might help.
Is that likely?
It's quite likely. And there's six or seven terrific people you could choose, including a couple of women.
Not Caroline Kennedy.
Would be interesting, but
that's what I thought.
Yeah. You remember when Cheney headed the committee to look for the last vice president and sort of looked all over and said, oh, gee, there's nobody. Oh, but there's me. Do you think Caroline Kennedy will do the same thing? We looked all over and just me.
She's sort of in there somewhere.
Don't ask questions. I always answer it. Dallas. And then we go to someone here.
Okay. My concern about your perspective this evening is it is so steeped in identity politics. Your concern on white men, African American, shades of African Americans, a white first lady, an old man, a drug dependent, possible first lady. And if I can just tease out what I think the point Anne was trying to make is that notwithstanding all the histrionics behind Obama, which you seem enthralled by, and a media who could not be more complimentary and hopeful to Obama, and a mediocre campaign to date by McCain, they're still line ball, it's still a competitive race. And being steeped in this identity politics, which I think has plagued the United States and with respect and affected some of your perspectives that we've seen tonight, absent all of that analysis is the issues. So you have a man whose international aspect in Barack is withdraw. You want to nationalise the health economy. he has some way out there perspectives and positions, and it seems to be absent from the perspective you brought here. And I think that's why you might find
Obama has some way out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I think you'll see that
an example.
Nationalizing the national health system of the United States is quite a departure from where they are. That's not the merits. The merits is another issue. I'm just saying, this is where it
may be. Sick in America recently?
Yeah, I think my point is that notwithstanding all of this, it's a competitive race that we still have. And in the absence of looking at some of the issues, which I think we'd hope most voters would concern themselves with, as opposed to shades of blackness or a female candidate.
Look, Hillary's gone now. That's that. America is racist. I'm not purposefully trying to. I hate identity politics. I said at the end, two very good people ran. But you can't. I thought for a long time that Obama would be able to transcend race, and then he gave that fantastic, a more perfect union speech. And then the Reverend Wright came on the scene, and it just sort of blew up in his face, and we were back down in race all over again. I mean, he was very clever in the way that he was getting away from race. I don't happen to think that his policies are way out there. National health system would be fantastic. All kinds of ideas are being mooted around. The fact is, the American health system is absolutely true. I mean, it's awful. I have friends who think that he's not as good on education as Hillary was, for example. Why don't you go on and look at McCain's site and look at the ideas he's got? It's really, you go, holy shit. That basically, that's your reaction. I mean, it's not good.
But if the candidate was Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell, would race be a problem then?
Sure. Absolutely. Why would you think it would not be?
I would have thought Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell are both very popular in the United States. McCain was known. McCain would have liked her on the ticket. Condoleezza Rice doesn't want to go into politics, but she would be a very attractive candidate.
Condoleezza Rice is not particularly popular. She's simply seen as George Bush's henchman. As for Colin Powell, he's basically, he whipped out, he's got a lot of black marks against him.
Yeah.
But the racial thing, I can't see how you could. It's there. It's the elephant in the room, like it or not.
So, hang on, over here, I missed something. Yeah.
My question's been asked.
Okay. So, who else have I. There's one here, who else have I missed? Okay, Lorraine. Yeah.
You tell me, an American friend stated that Obama came through the Illinois political ranks, which he compared, perhaps unfairly, with New South Wales Labour Party right. In other words, he's not a total innocent.
No, not totally.
The Jewish vote appears to be significant, and I was interested that on the internet a very strongly anti-Obama notice appeared, really indicating all sorts of bad things in terms of Palestine.
And McCain has been over there.
Obama himself has made fairly strong comments about his support for any action against Iran, and I think he's also supported the total control of Jerusalem by Israel.
Briefly.
Do you think IPAC or any of those lobbies will have any significant effect? The point I'm making, I think, is
that... What lobby is this? You said IPAC.
AIPAC is the fundamental...
Okay, that's the umbrella Jewish organisation.
Exactly.
Okay, right, that's fine. So
you can get deep into the weeds of the various policies. I mean, this is what you're asking me to do, say, I can't do that at the moment. I simply don't have the knowledge. I'm not an expert. I'm merely an observer, trying to piece it all together. And I was trying to work out, could this be a tsunami election or not? You know, would the McGovern factor kick in? That was basically in my mind. And I also wanted to cover the markets. I don't know, truly. I mean, we're going to hear about it at length. I believe that Obama has said that he will debate McCain across America, and we'll see.
I wanted to know what Sophie and Stanley thought about it. I find it fascinating how you've gone from Wall Street to Sophie and Stanley, or Stanley and Sophie. But they're not just jobs, are they? They're sort of an indication of your life.
Can I read a little bit?
Yeah, that's great. Because, you know, did you find this was the best thing to write about in the middle of George Bush in America? As a sort of escape?
It was an escape.
I wouldn't leave it there, I'll sell it.
Well,
oh, it's an American thing.
I'm sorry that I'm unwilling to get into the weeds of the various details of I wish identity politics, I wish it was not the case, but unfortunately it is. Okay. If I'd been doubtful about PAC behavior, if I could stop the wind blowing, I would. If I'd been doubtful about PAC behavior before, I certainly wasn't after watching Stanley and Sophie in action. At home, they noisily acted out their rivalry, sound and fury against cunning. Sophie was cunning. But outside, they joined forces and became a gang of two bent on rumbling the neighborhood. They divvied up the dog population. Stanley took on the large dogs and Sophie the small. Oh, Sophie, you fooled many an unsuspected Chihuahua, Pekingese, Shih Tzu, and Toy Poodle. Stanley missed saying hello to his old friends, but what can a boy do? Dog owners in the neighborhood now crossed the street when they saw us coming. I decided that I had to instill some real discipline. The two of them were to walk next to me, at heel, not veer off at whim, acting like the wayward front and back end of a vaudeville pantomime horse. Any infraction and we stopped, and they had to sit until they regained their composure. Dog ownership gives New Yorkers a reason to loiter rather than to hurry, to appreciate, in the case of my Upper East Side neighborhood, a melange of brownstones, carriage houses, low and high apartment buildings, the spanking new and tilting old and everything in between. In New York, bricks and mortar seem almost alive, a composting midden of the city's eras, architectural conversations galore. Dog ownership also gives us a cover to stare unabashedly through windows, especially at night, and imagine the lives we live in, to approve or sense a decorating intent. The art seen this way can be particularly rewarding. Is that a Moore, a Lichtenstein, a Basquiat? Loitering was what I was doing one evening, checking out some low white federal houses while the dogs sniffed. We passed a popular Italian restaurant when we came to a federal house painted a cheery pink with black trim and a front door that abutted the pavement. At that moment, Sophie decided to fly at a miniature Yorkshire Terrier. After the owner of the Yorkie glared and hurried on, and we three stopped while I bent over Sophie, making her sit and think about what she'd just done. Out of nowhere, in retrospect, he'd probably been bending an elbow at the bar in the restaurant. A man appeared, looming over us. Grey suit, yellow tie, tortoiseshell glasses, burglar-like corpulence, a lawyer for sure. Your dog is pissing on my door. How dare you allow that to happen? His face was mottled with red, and a glob of spittle landed on my surprised, upturned face. I looked behind me. Stanley was sniffing at the man's front door. He's only sniffing, I said, standing upright. We were nose to nose. He hasn't done anything. The man, arms akimbo, launched into a tirade about the unsanitary habits of dogs and their irresponsible owners. I think he might even have quoted John Sparrow, a curmudgeonly Oxford don who famously steered the unsavory engine of pollution, the dog. After that literate beginning, our guest had descended into expletives. I interrupted to inform him again that my dog wasn't guilty of anything. Then I made the mistake of trying to be reasonable. Look, 3,000 dogs must pass your door every day on their way to and from Central Park. To stop them from peeing on it would be like asking the wind to stop blowing. 3,000 was an exaggeration, more like 1,000. If I could stop the wind blowing, I would, he bellowed. I stepped out of spittle range. Oh, you have to be a Republican. This was just after George W. Bush was re-elected in 2004 with what he regarded as a mandate to steamroll the Constitution. A bitter time, a nation divided, split by a cleaver. Of course I'm a Republican. I walked the dogs over to the nearest lamppost and turned to ask the man, is this okay with you? We'll see. With a little distance between us, I felt emboldened. You know, I'd hate to be you. I'd hate to know what passes through your mind every night as you go to sleep. That did it. You roared and pawed the ground, and the dogs and I beat a hasty retreat down the street. We were almost at the end of the block when I looked back. The man was still there, still ranting and raving. I did the only thing a reasonable person could do. I gave him the finger. From then on, whenever we passed his door, I encouraged his dogs to pee on it. What can I say? Feelings were raw that year. Stanley always refused. A Republican front door was beneath him. But Sophie obliged. She hoisted her bottom high in the air and splashed her message on the glossy black paint and looked at me for approval. Good girl, Sophie. Darling Sophie. Best girl in the world.
Right down the back, yeah.
Can I ask you a personal question arising out of the last question? As a supporter of Obama, would you be troubled by the fact that when he addressed that APEC meeting and made some statements which were enthusiastically applauded, within 48 hours, he backtracked and stopped down?
Well, I think she's not an expert.
Well, actually, I've been on the road. I've been in Australia a month. I usually read the FT and the New York Times from cover to cover. I'm aware of this, but not deeply, deeply aware of it. I think he's making missteps. Yeah, sure. We're yet to see. My whole point of this speech was the pig and the poke. We don't know. We just don't know. Will he be up to it? But then again, will McCain stick to what? I mean, McCain's all over the place. McCain, the last time he ran, very much a maverick, more of a Democrat than a Republican, and now he's gone way over to the other side. I mean, we're talking politicians here.
48 hours seems a short time.
Sorry?
You said 48 hours is a short time.
Yeah.
Than usual.
Right. Huh?
Not in an election.
Shorter than usual, for change of mind, yeah. Right. So who else is anything on dogs, veterinary issues, American elections, yeah?
Kate, how worried are Americans that something might happen to President Obama in terms of his personal safety?
Extremely worried, yeah. I just, before I left, when I watched him giving the speeches, the one thing that was, apart from the speeches, was fantastic, that when he left the stage, he had security guards around him, more like a flat, one after the other. I mean, not spread out. Usually there might be four or five around, but they were like armor around him. And he's a tall guy, and these guys even taller, and they would let one person in at a time. And you would see them with Hillary, and you'd see them with other people, but not in that way of just completely surrounding him. And let's not forget that America has a tradition of doing that sort of thing. I think they're very brave to be running, actually.
Mm-hmm. You had a passage on Cipriano's that you said you skipped because you thought it was short of time. It sounds interesting. and tantalising if you've got something.
Okay.
I think we'll make this the last point. We'll finish on the book.
Okay.
That's all right.
That's what I'm here for.
I was picking up heads. I just wanted to sort of illustrate.
Speaking to the moment.
I just wanted to illustrate life in New York in a fashion. When I worked on Wall Street, I came into contact with extreme and often ludicrous wealth. But that was some time ago. Early in the new year, I was invited to dine at Cipriani's, which is catty corner from the Plaza Hotel, recently transformed into luxury condos that sold for prices nearly as stupendous as 15 Central Park West, even the ones with views of air shafts. Now, the crowd at Cipriani's, I don't know how many of you, anybody been to Cipriani's? They're polished. They're polished to a fare-thee-well, burnished. Their feet rarely touch the pavement. The food is mediocre. Mediocre at best. I'll take a meal at Sean's at Bondi anytime over Cipriani's. But it is expensive. The point being that its clientele are the sort who can afford to throw away a thousand or two for a modest weekday supper. The most polished of them all is the Egyptian maitre d'. And the two men I was with, my dentist and my neurologist. Now, you can tell I'm getting old. I'm socializing with my dentist and my neurologist. Be that it is. When the neurologist came in, he was a little late and had come straight from the office. And I think his collar was a little, not straight. And the Egyptian maitre d' came up to him and said, he went to do an adjustment of the collar. But it wasn't just a little adjustment. It was a major arms around and pulling and tucking. And then finally, after about 3 minutes of this, he steps back and says, we do like our gentlemen to look good.
Did they admit dogs?
Hang on.
No, they don't. My two companions
come back
I would... My two companions I were chatting in a spirited way when suddenly they both fell silent. A respectful 3-second silence. Private equity king Henry Kravis and his entourage were being seated at the table next to us. I was oblivious to this notable arrival. Instead, I was taking in the women in the room. They were all thin, that goes without saying, and every last one had faces that had gone under the knife more than once. To me, they looked just not unnatural, but malformed and grotesque. Feminist that I am, I couldn't resist mentioning this. My dentist then told me about a patient of his who was about to have some wrinkles, Botox, when the dermatologist informed her that after the procedure, she wouldn't be able to say the letter P. I gave a very unladylike cackle and said, there are women in this room who can't say whole words. My other companion, the neurologist, usually a light-hearted sort, reprimanded me. Kate, if you want to be a player on the Upper East Side, you have to work at it. It is deadly serious, actually. For men, this means staying wealthy and giving money to the right charities in significant amounts, although even that won't guarantee a table at the Four Seasons. The rules of this tribe are inscrutable. For the women, it means approximating a look of youth and maintaining the air of a courtesan. Once upon a time, women had their feet bound or wore corsets so tight they suffered renal failure. Now they endure mutilating face jobs that cause linguistic difficulties. But to the diners at Cipriani's, who keep company only with each other, the women appeared normal. And so it is with bankers. Keep company only with people who are conger eels, and after a while, that seems normal too. And by the way, at that time, Mayor Bloomberg was thinking of running, and both my companions would have voted for him. Everybody in that room would have voted for Mayor Bloomberg. Jewish, good manager. They would have loved him. White man. Sorry, the dead of the
body. Many thanks. Thank you. Well, it's great to have Kate Jennings back at the Sydney Institute. She always gives a lively speech. There's always lots of discussion and argument, and that's really what we're all about. As I said, she'd be happy to sign some copies of
Stanley and Sophie. It's had wide bipartisan support in the United States, being purchased by Obama supporters, Clinton supporters, along with Republican dog owners and drug dependent types. So it's great to have Kate back. Thanks for the paper, and good to hear your reflections, your notes from New York in an election year. And as you said at the start, it is a fascinating year in the United States, and we're all following it closely here. We envy you being in New York watching it, but it's going to be a great year, and perhaps sometime in the future you'll come back and reflect on your predictions, all of which we've taken careful note of tonight.
Actually, I have to write the quarterly essay for the monthly. I've got one with a pen I do in it,
So when did your quarterly essay come out?
It will come out at Christmas, but I have to have it done 3 days after the election closes.
Well, you'll get the result. You'll get the prediction
get
right.
The, the problem with it is that it really is, the stuff is so plowed over. It's hard to be original. Then again, back in New York, I mean, I'm plugged back into this thing, and I feel it with, I mean, we're energized. Everybody I know is energized. I've got a group who meets every Saturday morning. Husbands and wives go at it. I mean, we're all, you know, fully engrossed in this, and we think about it like 75% of the time. I mean, it's really, really important to us.
This is the first occasion on which my summaries have been commented on, you see. So we better cut it out there, otherwise... So many thanks, Kate. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.